WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
These are just anecdotes, but it's building up into something more coherent.
You know, I think it'd be interesting just to really try to unravel what his ties are.
There's a sort of country-city divide.
They're inconvenient ends, and it's not clear where it goes next.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Since the inauguration in January of Donald Trump, there's been a kind of protest renaissance in the country, with people on the left and some in the center of American politics dusting off the tactics, the chants, and the songs that became symbols of resistance during the civil rights and Vietnam eras. But a lot of the people doing the protesting today weren't around in the 60s, not by a long shot, and it's by and large a young person's game. And social media has changed what it even means to protest, whether all the singing and chanting is even necessary anymore. The New Yorker's Vincent Cunningham talked to two young people who were involved in a concert performance put on by the theater company called The Team that tried to get at that generational divide.
I mean, I sometimes wonder about people who are teenagers now because in some ways they might be better suited to deal with the particular chaos of the moment than any of the rest of us. But the only view that we get really of people at this point significantly younger than myself are young people on college campuses reacting to whoever the latest campus speaker is. And that, I think, is a very unfair reduction of what the real energy there is. It certainly can't just be that. Primer for a failed superpower is really sort of a simple idea. It's a group of people singing protest songs. The complexity comes in two ways. One, what is a protest song? So I never thought of Smells Like Teen Spirit as a protest song. It's one of the songs in the concert. And the other feature is that these songs are being sung by people who fall into three large age categories. First are baby boomers, older people, a bridge generation, as they called it, of 30-something people, and a younger group, which they're calling teens. I visited a rehearsal for Primer because it seemed to be an exercise that would really illuminate the differences, but also hopefully some of the similarities between generations.
I thought my whole life that I was a millennial,
genuinely,
and I've been, like, broadcasting, oh, yeah, I'm a millennial, we're going to change the world. But I found out that, like, I didn't meet the cutoff because I was born in 99, so I'm a part of Generation Z.
I mean, millennial was, like, originally coined to mean somebody who's going to come of age after the new millennium.
Right.
And, like, I will come of age after the new millennium because I was born, like, the after the new millennium.
So I invited two of the teenagers that I met at this rehearsal, Maxwell Weiss and Logan Rozos, to just talk to me about how it had been to learn these songs alongside so many other politically minded people, but of these different ages. And are you guys both in high school?
Oh, I just graduated, thank God.
Just graduated.
I'm going to be a junior in the fall.
Going to be a junior. What was your involvement with protest before the show?
Oh, you want me to go first? Okay. Yeah. My parents, took me to a lot of marches as a kid. I went to the Women's March. Probably the first, big piece of theater I did was an experimental opera about boycotting meat in the early 1900s. And my grandfather was a union delegate to the teachers union, and I never met him, but, my family knew that unions and, labor was really important.
Just being an activist was kind of always in my life. I remember in middle school, I did a small protest because they wouldn't let boys wear nail polish.
Mm-hmm.
So I did, a walkout in my class.
And so I wonder, sort of, just as a matter of your generation, right? So much political speech, so much political thought gets done online. I wonder how you guys feel about traditional protest, whether for your generation it makes as much sense as the other ways of communicating, just the
Facebook
sort of
status.
Exactly right. Instead of outside with a picket sign, is there a way, does that feel old or anachronistic to you? Or
I think currently activism and being woke is trendy. So right now everybody wants to be politically engaged, not because they think it's right, but because they think it's popular. But when I met Primer, I started talking to the baby boomers and the millennials about their type of protest. And I remember, one of them told me that nothing gets done by sitting down in your room. You have to go out. You need to gather as a community and visually be there.
But at the same time, I'm not sure how prominent of a role marching and, picketing will have in the future of activism. I do think it's important to meet with people who share a common goal. But I think that, we have so many new tools that have emerged since the civil rights movement that, we shouldn't necessarily be using civil rights movement era tactics to achieve our political demands.
I know the one thing we did right was the day we started to fight. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on.
Most of the music in the show I was never exposed to just because I grew up in Bushwick. So, the music I knew was, Wu-Tang Clan, TLC, Biggie, or, Chicken Noodle Soup, Soulja Boy. they legit taught us Chicken Noodle Soup in my school for my graduation song. I cannot lie
Amazing.
About that. But then I think with this show, I remember with this show specifically with music, I asked all the older generations, can you tell me an album that I must go home and listen to. Remember one of our castmates, Jake, told me about this cover of Smell Like Teen Spirit by Patti Smith.
Okay.
I have so much great music now that I really wish I would have listened to as a kid. It would have probably made me a lot stronger.
Yeah, I got introduced to so much new music and also reintroduced to music from my childhood. My dad is a huge Stevie Wonder fan, but when we did Village Ghetto Land, I was oh. Because it doesn't protest against a particular issue.
Right.
People might not see it as a protest song. They might see it as a personal song. But, I think in recent years, more and more, the personal and political have been indistinguishable from each other. And, Jake talked about, how our generation and his generation's protest music doesn't know what it's protesting. Because there's this idea that everything is so messed up, including ourselves, and we can't avoid being part of the problem. So, how do you pick one thing to fight against?
First of all, I was so excited about this because I love Village Ghetto Land. I'm also a big Stevie Wonder fan. I love it. Talk to me about, because there was Village Ghetto Land in there. There's What a Wonderful World, which is such an interesting contrast.
Brilliant.
There.
What a wonderful world.
It was a pretty explicit dialogue between the teens singing Village Ghetto Land and the 30-somethings and the baby boomers singing Wonderful World. Like, we've known nothing else but, like, crushing poverty, and we live in this, like, awful ghetto, like, look at us. And the adults being like, it's anyway, fine. Look at that rose.
Yeah, like, look at how beautiful
it's
life
so
is.
It's so pretty.
Why are you upset?
Did that sort of, some of those things echo what you saw in the actual dynamics between the generations, like about them being blind to the problems of young people? Did you feel that?
Not to any, like, significant extent, yeah. But a couple times, like, it's just not possible for us to fully understand each other because so much new vocabulary has been established, especially yeah. surrounding, like, LGBT issues.
Yes, I think of, like, pronouns. A lot of the older cast members never really understood the fact that there's non-binary people because it wasn't a privilege that they have.
The younger cast, I feel like they've had so many, like, experiences of, like, things already changing and like, getting
better. By younger cast, you mean the people, like, the literal children I met.
The literal
like,
children.
They were, like, eighth graders.
Right? Yeah. Sumaya's 13, Zaida's 14,
Gigi's 12, Zach is 13.
Wow. And I remember, like, coming out was such a hard thing when I was talking to Gigi, and then Gigi said, you know, you didn't have to come out. You never developed into being gay. You were born gay. She was like, when you tell people that you're gay, you're just giving them the power to approve you. If you approve yourself, then who cares? And I remember, like, Gigi telling me that, and then,
that's
like,
wild.
An hour later, she told me that she was 12. And I remember at 12 years old, I was having just such a hard time understanding what gay was.
Come all of you good workers, good news to you I'll tell.
I'm a lot more knowledgeable and politically engaged than I was before the show. And before the show, I thought I was, like, extremely engaged. But after meeting all these people with all these different stories and all these different pains and accomplishments, problems and solutions, there's different spectrums of protests and different variations and different levels. Like, saying a trigger warning or giving pronouns is a type of protest because you're enforcing an idea that you want to be inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
I think, like, I'm probably going to grapple for, like, my whole life about the most effective way to bring about political change. And, like, I'm not going to write off checking in somewhere on Facebook, and I'm not going to write off marching in the streets, and I'm not going to write off, like, weird experimental operas about meat strikes. I think that there's so many different ways to do things. And
there's no, like, one certain
there's
way
no,
to
there's no, like, perfect way to protest. Like, it's not, like, either you live up to this ideal or you're just wasting your time.
Yeah.
Like, Gen Xers, one thing that someone pointed out to me that I hadn't realized before is they love to take notes.
Like, they do. That's the, all they did was
the
take
day
notes.
When we
they had, like, a whole pad full of notes.
Yeah.
I feel so triggered right now. I know exactly what you're talking about.
The New Yorker's Vincent Cunningham spoke with performers Maxwell Weiss and Logan Rosos, who were in Primer for a Failed Superpower last month. Now, I know you weren't counting, at least I hope you weren't, but this is episode number 100 of the New Yorker Radio Hour, a little milestone for us. And over the last 2 years, I've introduced you to many of the people who make The New Yorker tick, the writers and cartoonists, and my colleagues on the editorial staff who are the heart and soul of the magazine. But the radio show comes to you every week because of so many more people than we ever have time to put in the credits. So if you'll indulge me for a minute, it's a special occasion after all, I'd like to call out a few of them. I have to start with Pamela McCarthy.
Hello.
The deputy editor and sort of the fairy godmother of the Radio Hour, and Dean Capello.
I want you to have options.
The godfather.
So.
Though not in the Marlon Brando sense.
Hi there.
Here at One World Trade Center, the ever vigilant Fabio Bertoni.
Hello.
Well, hello, Radio
Peter
Hour.
Canby and the whole amazingly hardworking crew of fact checkers.
You're always on the record unless they say.
Mike Luo and David Rode. Wei Chu, Susanna Kempel, and Nathan Burstein.
Happy 100th episode, New Yorker Radio Hour.
Natalie Raby, Erica Hinsley, and Adria Piazza.
Hey.
Deanna Donegan, and many of her illustrators, especially Rebecca Mock and Richie Pope. Bruce Dionne.
What are you doing?
Cassandra DaCosta, Rhonda Sherman, and the New Yorker Festival crew, Risa Leibowitz, and Lisa Hughes, the publisher of The New Yorker.
Just like, hi.
Now, a mile north of where I'm sitting at WNYC is Melissa O'Donnell, the infinitely diligent Sarah Sandbach,
hi,
Michael L. Sesser, Melissa LaCase, and Alicia Allen, Hal Trencher and his team in sponsorship, Peter Weingart and Mandy Naglich, and Yuri Kim.
Oh my God, are you actually?
Valentina Powers, Aaron Cohen, technical guru is Rob Christensen, Greg Gasparino, and David Satkowski, Jennifer Houlihan Roussel, and David Catrone, Theodore Kuzlin, and Robin Billenkoff, Michelle Rusnick, and Michelle Halliburton, and Edward O'Connor, John Chow,
hello,
and Laura Walker.
Hello, New Yorkers.
The president of New York Public Radio. If it takes a village to make a radio program, I'm paraphrasing, this is a very special radio program, and it takes two villages. I'm grateful to everyone who helps us to do this thing every week, and most of all to you for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrato. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.